join it.
No.
But we enjoyed ourselves, made a lot of friends, or made one friend.
Made one friend,
yes. Saw a bunch of dogs.
Saw some dogs behaving badly.
Some behaving well.
Some owners behaving badly. Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much. We got to get out of here. Thank you, Althea.
We will be back next week.
We will be back next week.
We got an exemption to the preemption.
Yes.
And we will see you then. Thanks for listening to The Gap.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m. Next up is Veterans Voice.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
Hey, we're Los Lonely Boys, and you're listening to KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9:02 a.m. Next up is a Veteran's Voice.
Well, how to do, Private William O'Brien? Do you mind if I sit here down by your grey side, and I'll rest for a while in the warm summer sun? I've been walking all day, Lord, and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the glorious fallen in 1916. Well, I hope you died quick, and I hope you died clean. Or Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they sound the fife lonely? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flute? some faithful heart is your memory and shine. And though you died back in 1916, to that loyal heart are you always 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, forever enshrined behind some glass pane in the now photographed, torn and tattered and stained and fading to yellow in a brown leather frame? Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they sound the fife lonely? Did the rifles fire on ye as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes of the forest? Well, the sun's shining now on these green fields of France. The warm wind blows gently and the red poppies dance. The trenches have vanished long under the plough. No gas and no barbed wire, no guns firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses in mute witness stand to man's blind indifference to his fellow man, and a whole generation who were butchered and damned. Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they sound the fife lonely? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lower you down? Did the bugles sing last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes of the forest? And I can't help but wonder now, Willie McBride, do all those who lie here know why they died? Did you really believe them when they told you the cause? You really believe that this war would end war? The suffering, the sorrow, the glory, the shame, the killing, the dying, it was all done in vain. For Willie McBride, it all happened again, and again, and again, and again, and again. Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they sound the fife lonely? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes of the forest? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flute to the forest?
Welcome, Portland calling. Sisters and brothers, welcome to Veteran Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, 104.3 in Corvallis, 91.9 in Hood River, or on the World Wide Web at KBOO.com. KBOO.FM. I'm Marvin, and again, Ty is our engineer, and Mike Hasty is our guest today. And I want to say hello to my friends, Gary and Darla in Nebraska, Kathy and Aloha, Mitty and her wonderful grandchildren, and my good friend Jim, who we text every day, and he's really good on lots of stuff. He's very helpful to me, and he's great. I just want to say that fundraising starting on August 20th, and you can donate by going to kboo.fm, and you'll see a donate thinger on there. You can just click on that. Or you can do, which I like, is you can go KBOO 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And you can do that. And let me see what else I got here before we start with Mike. $40,000 and counting, the struggle to keep track of Gaza's deaths. And, you know, I talked about a couple months ago, I think, I talked about what the UN figures that 90% of all people killed in war are civilians. And out of that, civilians, the children, you know, are just getting slaughtered over there. And nobody, the world's just not doing anything, you know. And Mike just told me about a picture, and that it was sent to him, man, from Gaza. And it just so sad, you know. It just made me just sad when I saw that picture. He has two pictures. I didn't see the pictures, but Mike was telling me about the pictures. And it's happening every day almost in Gaza. Every day in Gaza, they're just slaughtering innocent people. And it's just unbelievable. 40,000 and counting, because, you know, they don't know the exact number of people who are still buried underground from the bombings of their homes and businesses and stuff. And some of them they'll never find, Mike, you know. Yeah. They'll never find them. And Palestinians killed as settlers torch homes and cars in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. Dozens of extremist Israeli settlers, many of them masked, rampaged in the West Bank Palestinian village of Jit on Tuesday night, setting fires to homes and vehicles. A Palestinian man was also reported killed amid the attack. Happens. And, you know, I saw this thing today, Mike, where it said that the Israeli government, you know, is recognizing that's a problem. But they're not going to do nothing.
No.
They're not going to do anything about that. The Zionists want all of that land. They want every bit of it. They don't want anybody on there but Israeli Zionists. That's all they want. That's all they want. Oh, and another thing that really got me, Mike, is the, you know, Israel fired into Lebanon and killed one of their, I think it was Hezbollah leadership. And then they killed another, I think this was Hamas leadership in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And all on the news you hear, you know, it's U.S., France, and U.K., you know. And all you hear is that Iran, just don't do anything about it. Don't, you know, don't retaliate. You know, it'll just cause more trouble. They never say Israel. They never say, Israel, don't do that.
That's right.
They don't do that. You don't hear it on the news. You know, Israel assassinated those people. That's all there is to it. They assassinated them. But not one Western country said to Israel, you know, that's, you know, did no sanctions on them. In fact, they're sending, the U.S. is sending them, I can't remember how much more armament. 20 million?
Yeah.
$20 million worth of more armament, you know, to kill Palestinian children. Oh, it just makes me so angry, Michael. Okay. Mike's got some wonderful things he's going to talk about Vietnam, and we'll hook it into Gaza, I'm sure. But oh, Mike just told me the Veterans for Peace awarded him the Mahatma Gandhi Award, Peace Award, right?
Yeah.
Ah, man, that's great.
I don't believe
Yay. It. Yay! Man, that's something, Mike. That's really something.
Thanks.
Oh, man, I'm proud of you. That was just really
great.
Yeah,
the Veterans for Peace National Convention is online this weekend. Starts today. So when I leave here, I'm going to go over to a friend's place about 2 o'clock, and we'll watch what they have for Friday, and then I'll go back over the next day and the next day, because I'll be with a couple of friends,
a couple of
activist friends, so we'll... Three of us will be together to talk about, you know, the convention.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Wow, where's it at? Where's the convention at?
It's being organized on East Coast time.
Oh, East Coast time.
Yeah.
So,
you know,
3 hours difference. Yeah. Here.
So,
wow, that's great.
So, yeah, they got some. They're going to have some panels about what's going on in Gaza.
Oh,
they're going to have some speakers. So. I'm looking forward to hearing some of that, you know.
Wow.
So
that would be interesting for you. It's too bad you could be there, you know, and have the award handed to you there.
Yeah. But they're going to announce, there's several other awards that they'll be giving, and they'll announce those on Saturday night.
Saturday.
Yeah, so.
Wow. That's a good one, Mike. That's a really good one. Yeah, the pictures that Mike told me about of the baby in Gaza, there's no way that could be put on the internet.
No.
They would take that right off.
Yeah, the photograph, I'm not going to say exactly what the photograph was. It was it's really to even say what the picture was. It showed a picture of an infant that was dead, and there were some other things involved in the photograph, but it's the same stuff that happened at the My Lai massacre. I mean, there were 173 children that were killed at My Lai, and 56 were infants.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was 181 women killed, of which 17 were pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were 60 older Vietnamese men that were killed. Noam Chomsky said that the My Lai massacre was a metaphor for the entire Vietnam War, which I believe.
Oh, I believe that with all my heart.
There was a Colonel David Hackworth.
Oh, wonderful
man.
Who
was well known, and evidently he was one of the most decorated, if you're going to use that term, in Vietnam. One of the most decorated officers from the Vietnam War. But years later, after the war was over, he said that there were hundreds of My Lais.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's just, you know, that's just ground troops. You know, we don't... Then you
talk about the bombing.
When you talk about... The United States was responsible for over 20 million bomb craters during the war. United States dropped 400,000 tons of napalm. Okay, the United States fired 15 billion pounds of artillery shells. The United States sprayed 20 million gallons of the deadly defoliant called Agent Orange. So, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. People, you know, I'm thinking more and more about the Vietnam War, because what happened in Vietnam is exactly what's happening in Gaza. It was, you know, the United States committed mass murder in Vietnam every single day.
Yeah.
And so, and that's exactly what's happening in Gaza. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of similarity.
I mean,
we killed 4 million Vietnamese during the war. And, you know, I was thinking today, for every Vietnamese that was killed, there would have had to have been, what, 5-6 people that were wounded?
Oh, if not more.
Yeah, if not more. So you have to think about all those millions of Vietnamese who were wounded. What happened to them? Did they die later on? And, you know, so, you know, I mean, I've been back to Vietnam 3 times. I don't know how many times you've been back. I know
a ton.
You know, so, you know, I spent a lot of time at the My Lai massacre site because I wanted to interview and talk to some of the survivors. So that was very powerful in itself. And then I went back. I went there. You and I went to My Lai in 1994.
94.
Then I went in 2016. And then I went in 2018 for the 50th anniversary of the My Lai massacre. So I know we talk about the My Lai massacre, but you have to remember there's, just like Noam Chomsky said, you know, it was that My Lai was a metaphor for the entire war.
Right.
And a lot of people just can't wrap their arms around that statement. They just, you know, people just don't know, because you know as well as I do, as veterans, you know, we know what our government does behind closed doors. You know, that's information that's not shared with the public, you know, in most cases. And you know, we got generations of people who don't know anything about that war. And then of course we went from Vietnam to Panama to Grenada. We went to, you know, obviously we went to Iraq, we went to Afghanistan. Now we have this proxy war in Ukraine, and now we are now supplying billions and billions of dollars worth of weaponry to Israel so they can commit mass murder in Gaza. So it never stops.
It doesn't. It just keeps going.
It just never stops.
Yeah. That's like, you know, over 52,000 Americans died in Vietnam. That's nothing compared to what the Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians went through. But it took 10 years to get to 52-something thousand.
58,000.
Yeah, 52,800?
No, it was 58,200.
Oh, yeah. 58,000.
Yeah.
But that took 10 years. But they've killed 40,000 in
about 10 months.
In 10 months in Palestine.
Yeah.
That is horrific.
Yeah.
That is just terrible.
Yeah.
And you know, they're doing that peace conference in Qatar.
Yeah.
You know, and the Palestinians, they said, why are we going? Because Israel is just going to say, no, we don't like it. And to continue to, you know, bomb and kill Palestinians. But, and one thing that Israel's just going to fight till the end is they want to keep troops in Palestine.
Yeah.
And Palestinians are not going to accept that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. How do you get rid of I think 7.2 million Palestinians in that part of the world? What is Israel going to do? I mean, how do you get, you know, what are you going to make all those people vanish?
They would like that. Yeah, but what are they going to do with them all? Israel told the Palestinians that they don't have the right of return.
Yeah.
And because if they had the right of return, that's a lot of people. You know, certainly. That would they'd be so strong.
Yeah.
And Israel does not want that.
Yeah.
They want to have the control of that. They want to get those people out of there. They want to move in settlements. You know, it's religious fanaticism, you know. It's what it is. And the ones that are doing it are the Zionists. They're just, you know, before the Zionists really came, there was no problem in Palestine, you know. When the Zionists came in 1948, that's when it all started.
Yeah.
And you can blame the French, not the French, but the British for that.
Yeah.
That whole mess was British fault.
Yeah.
So
I know for me, you know, I went to Israel and Palestine in 2013. I went over there with about five members of Veterans for Peace. We were a peace delegation.
Yeah.
So I got involved in five demonstrations when I was in various towns in Palestine. One particular demonstration was against settlements, and
that's a big one.
So we were carrying a banner. I had two cameras, and we were with a couple of hundred Palestinians, and we were being tear gassed. I cannot believe how much tear gas was fired at us. I got into a situation where I got tear gas so bad I couldn't see anything. And I was just in a kind of a whiteout, and somebody reached over to me and grabbed me by the wrist. I never even saw their face because it was so smoky. And he led me over to an ambulance, and then they washed my eyes out. And I was in the ambulance for about, 5 to 10 minutes. And then I got out of the ambulance because I was doing much better. So I just continued to take photographs. And there was one situation where I was standing taking photographs, and an Israeli sniper fired two rounds at me, and they landed about 5 feet from my feet.
Mm.
And I'd like to think they were harassment rounds, which they probably were.
Yeah, because they're a good shot.
Yeah, because I'm glad he had a scope, because I'm sure when he put the scope on me, I looked like a foreigner.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that was a powerful awakening for me to see the racism. It was always the superior talking down to the inferior. And you could see the look in Palestinians' faces, you know, just walking throughout Jerusalem and being in a lot of the other communities, Hebron, Jenin, a few other towns that we were at, but it was so obvious.
The stress,
the racism was amazing.
Yeah, that whole stress of that, you know. The racism, which is rampant, you know, and the violence. The Palestinians have been through a lot.
Yeah.
Mike, talk about, which one do you want to talk about, these pictures? Mike's making a book, and it's really good.
I started working on this. It's a photo, a book with text under each photograph. So I took some photographs when I was in Vietnam, and then I made three trips back, but I created a lot of anti-war images because I was committed to do that. I was committed to tell the truth about what really happened in Vietnam. So I spent a lot of time, and Marvin and I went into a lot of high schools, colleges, and we spoke. And so what I would do is I would print up 8x10 photographs that I had taken, either black and white or color, and I would mount them on 12x16 black mat board, and then I would put the photograph near the top, and then I would put text underneath the photograph. And then what I would do is go into the classes. I might take 25, 30, 35 mm-hmm. of these panels, and I'd put them on the lip of the blackboard.
Yeah, I remember.
And or I'd put, you know, put them, you know, I would put them in chairs, or I would put them on desks or tables or whatever. So when I got up and speak, all I did is grabbed a panel, because every panel had a story.
Every, you know, that's true.
And so the kids, you know, we didn't pull any punches when we were talking to these kids. And I remember telling them, I said, as far as I'm concerned, being in this classroom is sacred ground to us. I says, we're not going to lie to you.
Yeah.
We're going to tell you what we know, what our experiences were, and what the experiences were of a lot of other vets that we knew. So we told them the truth about the Vietnam War.
Yeah. We sure did.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you. I had a lot of boys come up to me and thank me for telling me what we said, because some of those boys were thinking about going in the military.
I know.
And they came up and told me, you know, I was thinking about going in the military, but I don't think I'm going to go in now after hearing you guys speak. So that's what we do. That's what you and I have done for years and years and years, decade after decade, is that we continue to resurrect the truth of the Vietnam War, because we want to keep teenagers out of body bags.
Exactly.
That's what we do. That's our task. Yeah. I do that constantly. I'm always resurrecting the truth of the Vietnam War, and I'll talk to any young person at any given time, about. Recently I spoke to a young high school girl at Lincoln High School a couple of months ago, and she interviewed me for an hour in the library.
Ooh, good.
Because their class was studying the history of the Vietnam War, and she was going to take what she learned from me and was going to write a paper, and then she was going to give an oral report during the class.
Oh, that's amazing.
So,
Lincoln High School is good.
I know Lincoln High School, we've spoken there many times.
Yeah.
So Wilson High School is another one.
All of them, basically.
But those were mainly. Then the most important thing really is to go into the working class high schools.
We got kicked out of one, remember?
Yeah. So, you know, and that's what we do. I cannot not do that.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the knowledge that I have, I feel committed to do that. And I know you feel as committed as I do.
Oh, yeah.
And all the other vets that, you know, that came into the same high schools and gave, you know, told stories.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's all about telling stories.
Exactly.
You know.
It's all about.
You know.
And those kids really listen to us, you know.
Oh, I have never seen high school kids so attentive when we spoke. You could have literally heard a pin drop when we spoke. It was amazing. They were so tuned in to what we had to say.
Yep.
And you know the reason why, Marvin? We respected those kids.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And those kids knew we respected them. Because we said, you know, we're going to tell you the truth. And they really appreciated
that. Yeah. You know, another person that really is good when they go into schools talk is Joe Lewis.
Joe Lewis, yeah.
He's wonderful. You know, he was wounded at Kent State in May 1970, and he's the same way. He's got to talk about it. He's got to tell the truth about that day, what happened to him.
Him
and the others, you know.
Yeah.
And he does it, you know.
But you're just absolutely committed to bear witness.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, you have to bear witness.
Yeah. You know, I wish that we could contact the kid in northern Idaho that was a prisoner in Afghanistan, I think.
Yeah, I remember the story.
Yeah. I would like to really talk to him about, you know, why he left his post, you know, and why he walked out of there, and, you know, what happened to him in those years that he was captive.
Yeah.
And I heard him talk one time before they let him go, when a helicopter landed and they let him go, that one of the guards that was talking to him leaned over and whispered something to him. And then this kid turned around and walked to the helicopter to get out of there. And later on, he said that guard says, "Don't come back to Afghanistan or we'll kill you."
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that story.
Yeah, or we'll kill you. And that's just amazing. Another one that's really good in schools is Brian.
Yeah, Brian. Brian, yeah. Brian Wilson with two L's.
Yeah.
Brian, I've known, Marvin and I have known Brian for
30?
Many years. I made a trip back to Vietnam in 2016 with Brian Wilson and his wife, Becky. And what Brian did is that Brian was in, he was Special Forces in the Air Force. He was a lieutenant. And he was on a Air Force base where there were a lot of American jets. And the jets were being flown by South Vietnamese pilots. And so he was his job was to do security on the base. So after he'd been in Vietnam for a couple of months, he started to figure out some things. And the thing that really changed his life is that he was asked to go with a South Vietnamese Arvin officer to go out and inspect some bombing sites that had just recently been bombed. So they went into four villages. First village he went into, everybody was dead. There was over 100 Vietnamese civilians that were dead. And he remembers walking through the village and he could hear a water buffalo with these loud groans because the water buffalo was going through a dying process from the bombs. And also the napalm that was dropped after the conventional bombs were dropped. And Brian came on a woman who was flat on the ground. She was dead. She had two children in one arm, and then she had another child that was also dead in the other arm. Her eyes were wide open. Brian made eye contact with her. And in his book, this is what he said to himself. He said, in that moment, and it only took a second, I got it. He realized that he was the terrorist in Vietnam. And that catapulted Brian Wilson to another dimension. And then let's fast forward. That was 1969-70 when that happened. Let's fast forward to September 1st, 1987. He is demonstrating with two other vets in Concord, California, and it's right near a weapons depot, U.S. Navy weapons depot. And so periodically, trains would leave the Navy weapons depot, and they would be hauling weapons that were going to Nicaragua, to give these weapons to the Contras that were fighting the Sandinistas. So Brian was on the tracks in a lotus position, in the middle of the track, and there was two other vets, that one on each side of him, and the train came through, and they had notified the commanding officer that they were going to be involved in a demonstration because there have been numerous demonstrations, okay? So, and it was very routine. The train would come out. The locomotives would be pulling various numbers of boxcars that were loaded with weapons. They would come out, and they would be, traveling at about 5 miles an hour. If there was people on the tracks demonstrating with, and banners and so on and so forth, well, the train just simply stopped. Well, this particular day on September 1st, 1987, the train speeded up to 17 miles an hour, and they ran over Brian, and they cut both his legs off. He had multiple fractures. And luckily, his wife was there. He had recently been married. She was a registered nurse.
That saved him, probably.
Yeah, and she had a car. And in the trunk were life-saving medical supplies that she just carried in the trunk of the car. And so she treated him immediately, putting pressure dressings on him. And eventually Brian was, you know, sent to a hospital to recover in San Francisco for 5 months. During the time that he was in that hospital, he got over 250,000 letters from all over the world thanking him for what he did. You know, this is the kind of person he is. Brian now lives in Nicaragua. And so he's a wonderful man. I have learned a lot from him. He is relentless with his activism. He is one of the most incredible men I've ever met. And he wrote a book about his life and about his experiences, and it's called Blood on the Tracks. The book was published in 2011. It has just recently been published in Spanish, Marvin.
Wow.
And it was just recently released in Nicaragua. So I'm hoping the book will, you know, will circulate throughout Central and South America.
Yeah, it will.
You know.
It will.
Because,
there's no doubt about it.
So anyway, you know, that was Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
And so there's a chance that I might go down and see him. I've been down there 3 times.
I don't think he's doing well.
No, I think his health is starting to fail. And I was down there, last time I was down there, I'm trying to think, it was about 5 years ago when the U.S. was in the process of trying to overthrow the government.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of demonstrations, and I experienced a lot of situations where I was on the road and we'd have to go through various checkpoints that there were people manning the checkpoints who were demonstrating against Daniel Ortega, who was the president then and still is. So I get the biggest kick out of people saying it's American. You hear American politicians, they talk about that Daniel Ortega is corrupt, that the Nicaraguan government is corrupt. I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. The United States has bombed 30 countries since the end of World War II, and we're talking about Daniel Ortega and Nicaragua having a corrupt government. I mean, we killed millions of people in Iraq. With sanctions, you know, there was a piece Leslie Stahl did a piece on television. What was that? What was the name of that program? 60 Minutes.
Yeah, 60 Minutes. That's right.
Leslie Stahl is interviewing Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State under Clinton.
Yeah,
and they were, of course, they had all these sanctions against Iraq, and those sanctions killed 500,000 children.
Mm-hmm.
That is well known to this day. And Leslie Stahl asked Madeleine Albright about that. She said, "You know, the United States through its sanctions killed 500,000 children." And Leslie Stahl said to Madeleine Albright, she says, "Was the price worth it, Madeleine?" And Madeleine Albright said, "I think the price was worth it."
I know, that just
holy
angered
cow.
Me.
Holy, when she said that on national television,
my God.
60 Minutes?
Yeah.
I think it was 1998 or 99 when she said that.
I remember that. Was
I
so
mean,
horrible.
You know, that information has been relegated to 100 feet underground somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, you know, those are things that you and I know. Obviously, you know, that 60 Minutes got a lot of coverage when that was, you know, but now, you know, that was over 25 years ago. So people don't know that.
No, they just,
they don't know that.
No, they look, they don't understand that. You know, and that's, you don't talk about Daniel Ortega. You know, the U.S. government says, you know, he's corrupt and all this. And we got a guy who was ex-president, and he's running again, and he has 34 convictions, felony convictions.
I know.
We have no idea where the money goes, you know?
I know.
They put out all these reports and everything, but they have those certain ones that they don't talk about.
Yeah.
They don't say how much money's in them. They don't do anything like that.
Yeah.
Mike, read.
Let me read. I got a piece that I'm going to read.
Yeah.
It's from a Vietnam veteran who wrote a book called The Things They Carried, and his name is Tim O'Brien. Tim O'Brien is well known. His book was very successful. Mm-hmm. And I'll just read what I wrote here. It's on a panel that I used to take into the high schools. I just start out by saying, in order to understand why the My Lai massacre ever occurred, a synopsis and history of what happened in Quang Nai province, which is where the My Lai massacre occurred during the war, would be helpful for the reader. I came across an article written on October 2nd, 1994, by award-winning author and Vietnam veteran Tim O'Brien. The title of the article is "The Vietnam in Me." These are Tim O'Brien's words. In the years preceding the murders at My Lai, more than 70% of the villages in Quang Nai province had been destroyed by airstrikes, artillery fire, Zippo lighters, napalm, white phosphorus, bulldozers, gunships, and other such means. Roughly 40% of the population had lived in refugee camps, while civilian casualties in the area were approaching 50,000 a year. Can you imagine that? Mm. 50,000 Vietnamese civilians were killed every year in Quang Nai province. These numbers, reported by the journalist Jonathan Schell in 1967, were later confirmed as substantially correct by the U.S. government investigators. Not that I needed confirmation. Back in 1969, the wreckage was all around us, so common it seemed part of the geography, as natural as any mountain or river. Wreckage was the rule. Brutality was SOP. Scalded children, pistol-whipped women, burning hooches, free fire zones, body counts, indiscriminate bombing and harassment fire, villages in ash, M60 machine guns hosing down dark tree lines and human life behind them. In a war without aim, you tended not to aim. You close your eyes. You close your heart. The consequences become hit or miss in the most literal sense. With so few military targets, with an enemy that was both of and among the population, Alpha Company began to regard Quang Nai province itself as the true enemy, the physical space, the soil, and the paddies. What had started for us as a weird, vicious little war soon evolved into something far beyond vicious, a hopped-up killer strain of nihilism, waste without want, aimlessness of spirit. As Schell wrote after the events at My Lai, there can never be no doubt that such an atrocity was possible only because a number of other methods of killing civilians and destroying their villages had come to be the rule and not the exception in our conduct of the war.
Oh, man, that's right on. That's just...
I mean, that's a powerful piece of writing.
It's a wonderful piece
by somebody who was there.
Yeah. You know, listening to that and everything... I go right back to Gaza.
Yes.
You know, I go right back to Gaza, yeah. What they're doing in Gaza.
Yeah.
They're just destroying that. The people, to those IDF soldiers, the Palestinians are less than people.
They're That's right. They've called them vermin.
Yeah, they call them vermin. Yeah, yeah. And they don't have a problem killing them at all. They just don't do it. They don't have a problem.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mike.
I have a panel and another one. It's a picture. The picture is almost about, I think it's 11 by 14. It's a picture that shows, was taken at night. It shows the Vietnam veterans off to the left, and then it shows the Washington Monument.
Mm-hmm.
Washington, D.C. was where I was born in 1945. But anyway, so it shows the wall off to the left, and you can just barely see the contours of the lines of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And then you see off at a distance the Washington Monument that is lit up, you know. And so I titled it, I said, The Wall, Vietnam, The Darkness. And at the top I wrote on the photograph, I said, the United States represents 4.2% of the world's population. Yet it has over 750 military bases around the world. What is wrong with this picture? Since the end of World War II, the United States has bombed 30 countries. The U.S. creates wars around the world to steal natural resources. War, W-A-R, stands for wealthy or richer. The reason most Americans do not believe this is because whenever the truth threatens one's core belief system, there is an urgent need to deny its reality. The truth is so unspeakable. If you do not know that the United States is a brutal, narcissistic world empire, then you do not understand politics in America.
Yeah, that's really good. And the picture is great. You did a great job on that, Mike. Just a great job.
And let me also on this image, I've got to quote Dalton Trumbo, who wrote the book, the famous book, Johnny Got His Gun, which is a famous World War I novel, an anti-war novel, okay? He was a Hollywood screenwriter, in the 30s and 40s. This is what he wrote in the book, Johnny Got His Gun. If the thing they were fighting for was important enough to die for, then it was also important enough for them to be thinking about it in the last minutes of their lives. That stood to reason. Life is awfully important. So if you've given it away and you ought to think with all your mind in the last moments of your life about the thing you traded it for. So, did all those kids die thinking of democracy and freedom and liberty and honor and the safety?
Yeah, that's a tough one, Mike. Oh, man, that's really tough. There, you know, in that book is so many good things, and you know, he really hit it. He was blackballed.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
He had to change his name so he could continue to be a screenwriter for Hollywood.
And also, the book was banned before World War II.
Right.
And, he didn't do very, we got about 8 minutes, Mike. You got another one you want to read?
No, well, I mean, I brought, this is a book I think I already mentioned there's a book that I'm writing, and I have a kind of a mock-up book that's in front of me that I put together. And there's some quotes here that I think are extremely important. And these are two of the first quotes that I use at the beginning of the book. I titled the book Death of a Core Belief System. Pictures Worth a Thousand Lies.
Yeah, and on the front is a...
And on the front is a picture I took in Vietnam. It's a dust-off helicopter, and the crew took white paint and painted Y on the nose of the helicopter.
That is just amazing.
I just couldn't believe
it. That's a great picture,
too. Why were we ever in Vietnam?
Yeah.
You know, well, this is the first quote. There's two of them, and they're both by Martin Luther King Jr. Mm. And these are two quotes that he said when he gave a talk about Vietnam on April 4th, 1967, in a church in New York City. He says in the article, "The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government." And then he says, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." So you can imagine, Marvin, how many billions and billions and billions of dollars in weaponry that we have given Israel so they can slaughter innocent people in Gaza.
Yep.
And then we wonder why we have so much poverty in this country. Every day that I drive around Portland, Oregon, I see nothing but homelessness.
Yep, me too. And when I was coming in today, down on Front Street, you know, I just, my heart just went, oh my gosh, what we could we do with just a portion of the military budget, just a portion of it. You know, we wouldn't have this trouble, you know?
I know.
Oh, man.
And this is something I wrote that I think is important in relation, in as far as really trying to understand what happened in Vietnam and what's also happening as in Gaza, as Marvin and I are speaking right now. I'll just read you what I wrote. Mm-hmm. "You do not bring the enemy to the peace table by just killing military combatants. You ultimately bring the enemy to the peace table by killing innocent civilians because they are military targets. The primary goal of the aggressor nation is to break the will of the people and their ability to defend their homeland. This strategy is as old as warfare itself. It is the great truth that has great silence."
Yep. You know, as long as Americans can buy telephones, they have food to eat, they have homes, the majority of Americans, you know, they're not going to really do anything until it really gets them, until it really hits their pocketbooks, you know. The rich, right now, you know, we see all this poverty around us, Mike, but then you hear that the stock market is booming.
I know.
You know, who really has that money in the stock market? It's not poor people. It's the ultra rich.
Yeah.
And they never lose.
Yeah.
They never lose.
Yeah.
If the stock market goes down, they buy stuff up. You know, when it goes back up, they get more money.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this horrible thing. And Mike, I want to thank you for coming, and I really appreciate you being here. And we'll be back on September 20th at 9 a.m. And there it is. Thank you, everybody. Thanks, Ty.
All right. Thanks, Marvin.
Listen to this.
Now, when I was a young man, I carried my pack, and I lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, "Son, it's time to stop rambling, there's work to be done." So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amid all the tears, flag waving and cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli. Well, I remember that terrible day when our blood stain the sand and the water, and how in that hell that they called Suvla Bay we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was ready, oh, he primed himself well. He rained us with bullets and he showered us with shell, and in 5 minutes flat we were all blown to hell. Nearly blew us back home to Australia, and the band played Waltzing Matilda. When we stopped to bury our slain, and we buried ours, and the Turks buried theirs, then it started all over again. Those who were living just try to survive in that mad world of blood, death and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big turkey shell knocked me arse overhead, and when I awoke in my hospital bed and saw what it had done, and I wished I were dead.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 10 a.m.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic